We're here with our guest, Jeffrey Leppendorf, who's been here before. Welcome back.
Hello, Alan. Great to be here.
Thank you, throngs.
The throngs are here.
We have a purpose for him being here, too, right?
Yeah, but he wears many hats, and I don't know which one he has on today.
Today I have my literary hat on.
Your literary hat. Jeffrey Leppendorf is co-director of the Council of Literary Magazines.
No, I'm the director.
The director.
I'm the director.
Where did I get this co-director?
I'm a shared director with...
Oh, a shared director.
...of two literary organizations, so...
Oh, I see.
Yeah, your organizations share him. He doesn't share it with anybody.
I see.
When you're with me, you're at two places at once.
My God, that's exciting.
It is exciting.
And as you know, he also works for Art Oh My.
Yeah, how most folks here know me.
Tom, you have a way of saying things just as I'm about to say them. I don't know. You're mind reading, I think.
No. I'm not going to speculate about that.
He is the director of the Art Oh My Music Residency Program. And he's a composer and a musician and a librettist and a writer.
Well, thank you. But today I'm here with my lit hats, which is I'm the shared director of the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses, which is in New York, but it's national.
CLMP.
CLMP.
Yeah.
Since 1967. Not me, but it. And
SPD.
SPD, Small Press Distribution, which is, the believe it or not, the world's only remaining nonprofit literary book distributor.
Wow.
In Berkeley, California, since 1969.
So you have to go out to California every now and then.
I am forced, poor me, to have to go out to the Bay Area on occasion. Yes.
Well,
to leave Hudson. I know, it's hard.
It is hard, especially in the wintertime.
Yeah, exactly.
But
pity me.
I think both organizations benefit from the National Endowment for the Arts.
They both do. It's essential. And, you know...
And that's why we kind of invited you in, because as we know, they are currently under attack. Or are they under
attack? Well, that's a good question. There is a sword, let's say of Damocles, dangling above the NEA, but we're in a state of not knowing. But during the state of not knowing, we really have to act, because once we do know, if it's bad news, it'll be too late. So to the back up, it's been hinted that the NEA and the NEH and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a few very, very tiny agencies, actually, that many of us care about greatly, might be cut from the federal budget.
Totaling something like $150 million?
You know, right now, the NEH and the NEA, they're always paired.
Right.
And they were created through the same legislation in 1965. Both of their budgets right now are both $149 million each, almost $150 million, which, just so folks really understand, that's nothing. That's like... tippy tip of a nose cone of an airplane. You know,
it's
really very little money.
Less than 0.0075%, and less than 1% of the budget.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, cutting them would do very little, but symbolically, they're easy to cut. And so, as we heard the other night in that kind of State of the Union speech, military spending is intended to go up tremendously. Where's that money going to come from? So we already know that the current administration intends to eviscerate the EPA by half. So that's a teeny bit of it. The rest has to come from somewhere. So there's a lot of talk on the Hill, but it's all rumor, that the nine little agencies that make up together only $500 million that of these things we really care about, like the NEA and the NEH, the National Endowment for the Humanities, could
they have great impact for a very small amount of money.
That's the thing, is it takes... Even the small grants that are given out have tremendous impact. And even those that don't receive monies don't realize the impact that has in two ways. So one thing that's not commonly known, 40% of that NEA budget automatically goes to state arts councils. So in fact, even an organization not directly receiving NEA funding that might get New York State Council and the Arts funding, and we're so lucky in this state to have such a strong and wonderful arts council, if you are getting a grant from NISCA, New York State Arts Council, a good bit of that grant may actually be from the NEA appropriation.
That's right.
So that's part of the sort of trickle down. And then even if you are an individual who doesn't directly receive funding from the NEA, you have to care, I hope, about, you know, museums and performance places and wonderful organizations that teach children art and culture and adults and provide performances and so on and so on. And we have, you know, such an art culture in this area.
That's right.
And ironically, it's also not merely feeding our souls, but it's part of the economic engine of this area. So it would be tremendously detrimental to lose
but you know, traditionally, they always, through the years this has happened, they go after the arts budget in schools, mm-hmm. as well as from these bigger agencies. It's just, there's a story about when they were trying to form the National Endowment for the Arts, some senator talked about, oh, you want to put tippy-toe dancers in the cornfields or something this. And then a few years back, there was this big sort of cry of censorship of artists because some visual artists, primarily, I think it was, did, you know, express themselves in ways that were abhorrent.
Jesse Helms had attacked the Robert Mapplethorpe exhibit in Cincinnati, and there was a case I may have it backwards, but I think just before that, called the NEA 4. You know, debacle, and it was four artists. Mm-hmm. Karen Finley's probably the most famous, but four artists who were funded, granted funds from the NEA, but they had not yet received the money. Mm-hmm. And then because of the Jesse Helms ridiculousness, their funding was pulled, and they sued the government, and they lost.
Really?
And because of that, the NEA changed. So
they stopped giving grants
to artists.
They
stopped giving individual artists. There's one exception, which is... writers and translators can still get individual grants, and I have to say I'm proud to be part of CLMP, the Community of Literary Magazines and Presses. My organization, together with another great beloved organization, Poets and Writers, created something called LitNet, which now sounds very digital, but it was before the internet. It just meant Literary Network. It was a coalition of literary arts groups in the country. We still meet. We're still active. And we're the only arts group that pooled money and hired a lobbyist. And that protected those fellowships. So you can still apply to the NEA as a writer, but you can't as a musician, you can't as a choreographer or a writer, and as an artist, et cetera.
Didn't they institute some sort of, not a loyalty oath, but something that you had to sign that you weren't going to do anything salacious?
They've done a number of things to try to keep it safe. And, you know, the main thing is by funding larger institutions, it's automatically kind of safe. So if you're funding ballet companies and big museums, they're less likely to produce, you know, potentially, let's say, problematic or edgy art, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a kind of, I sometimes say it's a dirty secret in arts funding. Often under Republican administrations, there's actually been greater arts funding.
I remember Richard Nixon actually increased the budget of the National
But you have to ask, but what were they funding?
Yeah.
And so there might be more money, but it's often funding larger, more conservative, safer things. So, you know, you always have to ask more questions. So under some of the smaller budgets, we've had greater art produced because it's been more smaller grants, including individual artists doing amazing things. And
but, you
that's
know,
our culture.
Andre Serrano, who was one of those artists that was slapped down during the censorship era, I think of it, is having a show right now
at the
in
school.
Kinderhook at Jack Shaneman's The School.
That censorship sure didn't hurt his exchange value.
I guess not.
So let's say it does go, the funding ceases. How would that affect, let's say...
For example, my like CLMP, for example, we would fold. I mean, I would do what I could to do emergency fundraising, but... we what's called a service organization, we're helping, you know, we're a helping organization. We're not putting on performances. We're helping others make art, right? And present art. We're helping small publishers throughout the country. So,
I'll often see your name in like the copyright page.
Yeah, exactly. We're a proud member of CLMP.
You'll see a number of organizations, you know, whether it's a state arts council, CLMP,
blah. As a service organization, we are particularly reliant on government support, who understand the role, the sort of secret behind-the-scenes role we play frequently. And it's a good third of my funding. We could not sustain it. Now, I would do my best to find some angels, but it would be really, really hard. And when you add into that New York State Council on the Arts funding, which is also significant for us, which would likely also be damaged, it might not go away, but it would 40% would be of that NEA funding would go away, I don't know how we could remain. And there are many other organizations that are the same. It would have a larger effect, in fact, on our state economy, because so much of New York State's economy is, in fact, arts economy. Individual artists are a big part of this economy, not to mention just the orgs. And they are supported by organizations and so on and so on. So.
I think former NEA chair Dana Gioia made this point both on NPR as well as in an LA Times editorial that the way to appeal to Trump is by emphasizing this fact, that it is an economic engine.
It really is. I mean, it would be foolish if one is concerned primarily with the economy, and fine, to cut the arts, because in fact, it is a genuinely viable part of the economic engine of this country. And thinking that it's somehow extra is false.
Yeah.
Let alone what it means, you know.
I think one example he pointed out, you know, we know that here in New York, of course, but he pointed out how it was the NEA that sort of, or how the example of the Spoleto Festival in Savannah, is it in Charleston or Savannah?
Charleston.
Charleston. Contributed greatly to their revival.
Oh, yeah.
You know, getting it there, and that was supported by...
It's been shown time and time again, when the arts move into... Look at Hudson. When the arts move into communities that have fallen on harder times, it is the arts that tend to revive them.
That's
and
right.
And look here. I mean, look at, you know, the Opera House and Time and Space and Basilica Hudson. Just here in Hudson, what the art institutions here have done to make this a destination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so... speaking in the language of the current administration, it makes sense to support the arts, but it's not always seen that way.
Because it spills over, too. I mean, those institutions generate all kinds of secondary activity.
Sure. But I wanted to say something about how you were asking about what the real threat is. So, you know, the way it's happened historically, I actually jotted down a couple dates. The first Monday of February, in every other year before now, the White House has announced its proposed budget. That's not the law that it has to happen then, so it's not technically late, but it's always been the first Monday of February, so it's already late. They have to do it by April. What happens is they announce it. Usually the president puts out what's called the skinny budget, which has the sort of big outline items, and then we get the details, and it's hashed out then. Once that budget's announced, changing it is really hard, which is why we have to be fighting for the things we care about now, not knowing the budget. At that point, there's only 4 weeks of, they call it discussion period, but it's kind of rebuttal. But it really doesn't change at that point. It's voted in, and this whenever this budget's announced between now and April, it's going to begin October 1st.
Now, he's announced no chair people for any of these positions either, has he?
No.
Is it true that he actually asked Sylvester Stallone to be?
That I do know for a fact that's a rumor.
That is wrong.
What is the rumor?
The rumor was that Sly Stallone was to perhaps be the new chair of the NEA. The chair of the NEA is a nomination, you know, by the president.
Right.
I will say off the record, I know people giggled at him, but he would have been great. I'll just say for the record, because
he might have been.
He
we
is
never know.
An art producer,
right.
And he would care about it.
Right.
You know, what may happen, I think it's less likely that it's cut entirely, and that instead it might be like the EPA, where someone who's put in charge, who might be put in charge to destroy it from within.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have a man running the EPA right now who is on record for being a...
Anti-EPA.
Yeah, exactly.
What... has there been any talk of possible nominations? Or
there is, but I can't say. I have a little insider information, but a few names have been bandied about, but nothing where people assume it will be that person.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
excuse me one second. Has a budget gone forward without a chair in place?
Yes, and you might those who follow these things might recall that in fact the current chair Jane Chu, who we adore, it's a shame that. She won't be able to remain if the NEA remains, and that still is a big if. She was hired, I think it was like something like a year and a half into the Obama administration. It's not the top of anyone's list, you know, up in the White House to appoint. So there have been long periods with no one as chair, and other folks will run it.
Because there is a whole staff.
Yeah,
in
there's
place.
A current staff, and they're great. The current staff at the NEA are just fabulous, like the staff at NISCA. And the people who are appointed change.
Right.
They have to keep running it.
Right.
You know.
A fact, which might be interesting, might not, is that the National Endowments, at least the National Endowment for the Arts, moved into the old post office building.
Which is now Trump's office.
Guess what it is now? I know.
And where did NEA go? Where are their offices now?
They are not too far away in a very nice, office building. But they used to be in this gorgeous post office.
Oh, it was amazing.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Spectacular
really was.
Landmark building. And it is now, we keep hearing about on the news, this Trump hotel that is questionable for people to be forced or not forced to stay
in. Have you been in the new building?
Yeah, many times.
Is the atrium still the same as it was in the post office?
No. It doesn't have a shopping mall in it. It was the post office was funny. It had a public shopping mall on the lower floor. And yet you had to still go through kind of crazy security to get upstairs.
That's right.
And there were these dark, I'm sure these are gone, unfortunately, panels hanging, which seemed like they were for sound deflection or something. And I forget the artist now. It turns out they were actually, it was actually an art piece from a very famous artist, but they'd become so dusty over the years and no one noticed them out there. I just heard about that recently. So that's it. But they're in a new building. They have moved. But what was known for many years as the Nancy Hawk Center, Nancy Hanks Center. Thank you. The old post office is now the Trump International, you know, hotel. So you can't make this stuff up.
How far are we falling?
Yeah.
Well,
but I have to say, you know, it's the way this works. I'm going to put this out because we have a lot of people listening who have friends all over the country. We all should be calling our local legislators. And here we have our legislators here are generally supportive of the NEA. Mm-hmm. So we want to call them. If you're calling Chuck Schumer, for example, call him and thank him. Because if push comes to shove and things to get negotiated, we want to be sure that that's not one of the things that goes. But the where you want to be calling are the people on the Appropriations Committee. But here's the rub. You have to live in that zip code because the first thing they ask you when you call the Capitol switchboard, can I give the number?
Sure.
202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121. Anyone can call. It's kind of amazing if you haven't done it. You call, a human being answers. They say, what's your zip code? And they put you through to your representative's office. Uh-huh. And a kind person will take your message down. And, you know, we all can sign petitions, and those are great. But it takes 100 signatures on a petition to equal one, what they call impression. One phone call is equal to 100 signatures.
A personal phone call.
Yeah, contact. It's called a contact. So those calls are important because these folks need our votes again. And that's what changes minds, right? So the Appropriations Committee folks are in Alaska, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, West Virginia, North Dakota, Kentucky, Tennessee, Idaho, Oklahoma, Utah, and Nevada. So if you have friends who live in any of those places, call them and tell them they must call their local folk and tell them, please protect the NEA and the NEH and whatever other issues they care about. And if you care about a bunch of issues, call every day with a different one.
And, of course, since we can't really do a call to action one way, if you also proof of cutting, might call those people as well. We got to say that.
Of course. But I can say, legally, I've done a lot of research. What I've just done is advocacy, not lobbying.
Okay, cool.
Because there's no legislative vote, which is what it takes to be called lobbying.
Right.
Simply advocating on behalf of something is advocating. Yeah. There is no vote right now, and there's no one in an election. So it's, by definition, not lobbying, just so everyone knows out there. Yeah. If you run a not-for-profit, you're allowed to say, call and tell people to protect the NEA legislators. It's absolutely fine. Cool. Doesn't break that rule.
It's interesting that Kirsten Gillibrand is...
kudos to her. Yeah, she put out a letter.
She led the fight in... Fight. I don't know what to call it.
Well,
anyway,
rallying,
she got
rallying
the other senators, too.
She got 24 senators to sign a letter in support, and that's powerful. It's important.
And we have a very strong ally in Dede Barrett as assemblywoman in Albany, which we don't know what will happen in Albany, but if trickle-down is working, something...
Yeah, which is why it's equally important to call the folks who are supportive and say thank you for being supportive.
That's right.
We need to let them know that they haven't wasted their time. It's really important.
That's right. It's like how here at WGXC we thank the underwriters when we see them out in public, don't we, Ellen?
Yes, we do.
I thanked Mr. Marchand, De Marchand recently, if that's his last name, for... And Alana Hauptman also, who I read that. You got to thank the people who support you.
That's right.
You do.
We like the NEA and the NEH are in a rough time because we're in the middle of a pledge drive. 6977400. If you'd like to ask Jeffrey Leppendorf a question, call in
right now.
6977400.
Can I read something just beautiful? I mean, I won't read the whole thing, but you know, I went back and read the original 1965 legislation.
Oh, I saw you published this on Lit Hub.
Yes, Lit Hub, which if people don't know about, is actually largely published from here in Hudson. But
that's right,
Johnny Diamond. But lithub.com, you can sign up and get these wonderful literary things. But I wrote a little piece on the original legislation, and I had gone back and read it, and having not gone back, I'd actually never read it, so I was curious, and I read it, and it's a really moving thing. And you can't believe that we don't all know this. I mean, I didn't know it. And I'm going to read a sentence. This is from, it was President Johnson at the time.
Wasn't Livingston Biddle involved?
Yes. And in fact, when I put out, because I couldn't find out who actually wrote the legislation. You know, legislation is usually not written by one person. Mm. And I do know the legislators who were thanked by Johnson in his speech, which you can watch part of on YouTube. It's pretty cool. But Adam Clayton Powell Jr., you know, a bunch of, you can hear the legislators, but it is likely that it was Biddle, who was then head of the NEA, became head of the NEA. There was no NEA yet. But Kennedy had created a committee. And I think he might have been involved with that, an arts committee. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of turned into the NEA. And in the Rose Garden lawn, when he announced this legislation, and then he gave the pens to Agnes DeMille and...
Agnes DeMille was, on the first New York State Council on the Arts Board.
Oh, was she? Wow.
I think so.
It was Ansel Adams got the other pen. There were two pens. Because it brought into... being both the NEA and the NEH, this one piece of legislation. But in Johnson, in his speech, he said this, and it's just beautiful. Imagine our current president saying this: art is a nation's most precious heritage, for it is in our works of art that we reveal to ourselves and to others the inner vision which guides us as a nation. And where there is no vision, the people perish. It's chillingly beautiful. Yeah, I know. But everyone should just, you know, Google 1965 NEA legislation. It talks about multiculturalism. It's really quite astounding. It talks about the importance of culture and art along with technology, and in some cases over technology. You know, we've heard a lot about STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. And a lot of folks have been calling for STEAM, you know, to put art back in there. Uh-huh. But it's addressed back in 1965. The importance of the arts and, in fact, understanding technology and using it for good. It's all remarkable.
I just want to say that the New York State Arts Council was formed in 1960, five years before the National Endowment. And people have always said, and I don't know how true it is, that the endowment in a way patterned itself after the New York State Arts Council, the system of how grants are decided and given.
That makes some sense in that the NEA still funds by art discipline, as does the New York State Council. You can apply in literature and music.
And a panel of your peers.
With a panel of peers, which I think is really important. Most other arts councils have dropped discipline-specific funding.
Really?
Yeah, which is a shame for certain disciplines who may not have representation on those panels.
Right.
So, you know.
How do they organize then?
By kind of theme, like presenting, arts and education, things like that. General themes that are all arts, you know.
Well, the New York State Arts Council was also, at the time we thought we were saddled with an overlay of geography.
We, Ellen? Yes. Have you explained why? How?
Yeah, tell us about your history with NISCA.
I was there for 11 years.
Wow.
But I wasn't in the grant-giving business. I was doing publications. Hmm. And information and publicity.
And I was an NEA panelist once. How do you like that?
You were?
Yes,
which
I was.
Panel?
Literature.
Really?
Yes, I was.
What year was that?
It was during the Dana Gioia years, so I can't remember.
Oh, then...
Not so long ago.
I was long gone.
Not too long.
I went to the National Endowment. So what was I saying? What was
The NEA was probably itself modeled, the way it works, was probably modeled on our own state arts.
But those panels came under, scrutiny many times because people said, oh, he got a big grant because he was on the panel. But they were very strict about making people leave the room.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's like jury duty. People.
It was pretty, it was incredibly honorable, the process, when I was there.
I like to think it's remained that way. I don't know.
No, I'm quite sure it has.
But I don't know. What is the New York State Arts Council budget like these years?
Oh, I wish I could rattle that off right now.
Compared
to other arts councils, we have either the second or the first or the largest.
Largest, yeah.
We're one of the best arts funders as a state. This state cares about art, so that's wonderful. Many states don't even have state arts councils or have no grant making from them.
Really?
Yeah.
They all had arts councils at one time.
Yeah, yeah. So we're very, very fortunate in New York. And of course, as we said, you know, 40% of that NEA money is going to state arts councils. So if the NEA were to be canceled, it would affect that funding. So it's not so apparent right away, but a lot of what we assume is what makes our lives wonderful, you know, would be in threat of going away.
Well, you know, one of the trickle downs is it's easy to see here in Columbia County because the National Endowment gives money to the New York State Council on the Arts. They give what they call decentralization grants to all the arts councils. Of course, our local arts council has closed down. Let's hope it's temporarily. But anyway, and they then give grants to very small organizations that are doing arts programs here in Columbia County.
Yeah. Those little grants can be incredibly meaningful. I'll tell you, my organization, CLMP, we also do some what's called re-granting, which is that NISCA gives us money and then we give out that money.
Well, and poets and writers is
they
always,
do it as well. So if you're a poet doing a reading or a novelist doing a reading at a bar even, you can actually get some money through Poets and Writers, but it comes from New York State Council originally. They re-grant it. Mm-hmm. That allows you to say you're a professional writer. It's very meaningful.
Right. And it's also a stimulus to getting the endowments money has always been that way. It is a stimulus to getting other funds from.
Yeah, it's legitimizing. It's
you got a grant from the National
Excellence.
Endowment.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. Because those things are vetted so carefully. Those panels are very, very competitive.
Yeah.
And so if you do get a State Arts Council grant or a National Endowment for the Arts grant, it does mean a lot.
Yep.
Even if the amount may indeed be small, it means more than the money. You know, I know
on the writing panel, one of the pieces of literature they gave us in preparation was included testaments from various writers who got their grants at a key moment in their careers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When they really had nothing, and it was the one thing that kept them going. And that's pretty powerful.
It is.
Yep.
Although I tend to think that the organizational support is probably more meaningful because it does spread it out more and it does involve, you know, more process and vetting.
Also, what's unfortunate is that the larger private foundation community has been pulling increasingly funding away from the arts to other things. And so that government support, you know, has been a lifeline for a lot of organizations like mine that get very little private foundation support but rely on government support who understand what a service organization does. So in the case of my organization, it's particularly important.
Is that larger problem that's going on with foundations in general where they're stockpiling money and not actually spending it?
Oh, no, they can't do that. By law, they can't. They have to give it away. What happens is they're all based on
But it's not a big percentage.
Invested money. No, it's small. And then they have to give that out.
Right.
And so if the economy goes down, they have less to give out. If it goes up, they have more to give out. So in the after 1988, you know, suddenly there was less money to give out. These things happen. Mm-hmm. But still, the percentages of where does the money go
has been
shifting.
Where is it going? To the environment?
No,
or?
I think what's even within arts funding, and here's where I'm going to be very opinionated. Other people might not feel this way. I get very, I hold strong feelings about some of this. I think what's happened in arts funding is that we've moved toward a model generally of what I sometimes call art as social service. So that the fact that something is great art isn't a reason to support it. I think it should be, right? Art doesn't have to justify itself. You know, if it feeds us, feeds our souls, it's done its job. But when a lot of us who have to apply for grants, we have to say things like, I'll exaggerate, but by producing this play, children in the local school will do better at math. By putting on this dance performance, the local Starbucks will sell more coffee, right? And so we have, art has these secondary effects, and we never talk about the effect of the art. We talk about the secondary effects.
A tyranny of instrumentalism.
Yeah, and so it's data-driven, and it's easier to measure certain kinds of things. Another thing that's happened is that we're seeing increasingly words like creativity, innovation, and innovation being used in the business sector, as they should be, and yet that is the realm of artists, but the money's going into businesses being innovative and the science is being innovative, and artists have been removed from the equation of bringing art into these industries.
Hmm.
It's funny Jeffrey mentions this, Ellen, because that article I was referring to earlier by Thomas Frank and the New Baffler, mm-hmm. talks about these very issues, how and this is a theme he's had going way back, how business and advertising and all these other industries have taken over this terminology of curatorialism,
right? Mm-hmm.
pretending to be, you know, right. art when they're just business.
Right, exactly. And it's not that scientists can't have creative problem solving. They certainly do. But artists have a different way of thinking about things that has great value and adds a lot to these other professions. And it isn't necessarily funded. So back to where the money went.
Mm-hmm.
It also had to do with the way that, as I said, things were counted. So it's just easier to fund things that have real clear metrics. Funding didn't used to be metric-based. You know, we would give stories and give examples, and now frequently we give data.
Right, and this is the dilemma in higher education as well.
Right, oh, absolutely.
You know, measuring things on metrics that...
That don't really...
Well, that don't even understand the usefulness of useless knowledge.
Right. And so we have art and the humanities are equally under attack,
right.
and they're both equally important.
Right.
And same thing, humanities departments in colleges and schools are being shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. They're seen as in service to other departments. So,
right.
you know, frequently you teach English, your value is not that people are literate and in fact, increase their ability to engage in critical thinking and be thinking humans, engage civic-minded people, which is what one becomes. You don't have to become an artist, but you're engaged as a civic human
right.
by having art education, right? But an English department professor might be seen as teaching writing to a business major
right.
for the purpose of being able to get a business degree, not for the value of being able to clarify one's thoughts.
Enjoy a novel.
Yeah, exactly. So, and again, ultimately that does affect the economy if that's what you
right.
care about, but it's not immediately
right.
apparent. So
right.
that's what's happened with, you know, a lot of funding, and I hope it will shift back. Pendulum swing, but right now it hasn't.
So the best thing you can recommend now is calling your friends in those states that are on the appropriations committee, where their representatives are on the appropriations committee. What other kinds of things can people do, you think?
On a routine level,
mm-hmm.
we need to care a lot about arts education. We need to insist that children learn art in school. Those programs are the first to be cut, you know, and they
right.
shouldn't be.
Always.
Yeah, so that's part of it. We need to, if we have kids, we need to take them to performances in museums and read to them and ask questions and encourage critical, creative thinking from a young age. Culture needs to be part of what we do every day. It is for many of us, but it isn't for a lot of people. And some folks don't even understand that they are involved in it, and it affects them, but they don't acknowledge it. One example, the NEA put out a survey through the census, and they asked, you know, have you read a book or a poem in the past year? A lot of people put no. And evil data showed, oh, it looks like less people are reading. What if they had asked this instead? Did you attend a funeral or a wedding where a poem was read and you were moved? That might change that whole equation.
Mm-hmm.
We're not counting that right now. So, you know, we have to think of counting differently. I sometimes say that which is not counted is not funded, and we've been undercounting art engagement and activity that actually is happening, but people don't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has written a poem in their life, even if it was a bad limerick when they were 10, but, you know, or a silly Valentine. But pretty much everyone has written a poem in their life. They might not think about poetry now, but they've actually engaged in it as a creator. So this is powerful stuff.
Wow.
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Jeffrey Leppendorf.
My pleasure.
Who is in charge, co-director, I'm sorry. he directs.
He's a
shared director of both the CLMP and SPD, which stands for Small Press Distributor, and Council of Literary.
Well, now we're the community of literary magazines.
Well, you know, I had it written as community.
Yeah.
And I thought I'd made a mistake.
No, we changed our name. We were clever. Same logo, different name. We didn't have to redesign everything.
So do you think this administration will listen?
They will listen if the people on the Appropriations Committee.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to.
That's what it comes down to. You know, if the people on the Appropriations Committee hear from their constituents who will vote them in again next time that they care about the NEA and the NEH, then it will remain in the budget.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
So you don't think it'll really come from the top?
No, I think, you know, the arts were not part on either side, Democrat or Republican, the arts were not part of running for the elections.
Right.
And we were all happy about that because it's not mentioned. We were like, don't mention the arts.
Yeah, let's not get into a conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So that has not been the issue right now. We don't have a Jesse Helms worried about Mapplethorpe. But a lot of us are concerned, look, surely some artist is going to make a grand gesture. You know, a Andre Serrano is going to put a little statue of our president and a glass and photograph it with liquid.
If you went to the show, he does have a portrait of Trump there.
Right, but it hasn't gone viral in the images. So.
But it's pretty reverential portrait, actually.
I'm sure. But the thing is that one clever poet, one Brooklyn Museum will show something that whose image or sound or whatever will go viral and will reach our president through Twitter. Right. And you know, he could shut it down. That could happen. It's a quixotic, you know, administration. But right now, it's about them trying to cut a budget. And the money has to be cut from somewhere. So we all need to make it known where we don't want to cut from. That's it.
There you
go. That's right.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for coming in.
Let your voice be heard.
Hope to see you again under better circumstances when you're promoting something at Oh My, perhaps, or some one of your own projects. Or playing that instrument that I can never remember that you play?
Shakuhachi.
Okay, there you go.
It's a flute, a Japanese flute.
Thank you.
Well, okay.
And you've written for it.
I have, quite a bit. Yeah.